Speaking of reliability. Friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
My name's Chris Jackson.
And this is Adam Barrett.
And welcome to Speaking of Reliability. And what Adam and I were just talking about was unfortunately a very common trait of organizations where CEOs and vice presidents essentially tell their workforce to do what they say to do, but they're not going to pay you to do that. And what I mean by that is they have initiatives, they have some sort of new paradigm they want to introduce to the organization, but essentially they tell their employees that all these pretty posters we've just put up in the organization are things you need to do in your spare time, in your lunch break. And I was wondering, Adam, have you had any experiences like this as well?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Both from the inside, you know, and the outside. I've been in organizations where that's occurred. Actually, I think I've left organizations where that has been evident. And from the outside, as a consultant, you know, helping teams, I've seen that as, you know, a root cause. And when you said you wanted to talk about it, I was like, you could tell right away. I was like, yes, absolutely. Because it's not only damaging to the program, it can be damaging to people, to their spirit, to their, you know, interest in their career, their passion. And you kind of want to, I hope people listening to this also kind of take away an evaluation tool set of how to look at these situations and make career decisions. It might be that, look, my interest in this doesn't match the way the organization does it.
And that's true. And I think that's when, let's just say a CEO as a nominal person in a senior position, when they do this, they put up the poster saying, here's our vision. You guys need to adhere to this vision. You need to work in your spare time to make this happen. Essentially, the message they are selling is, I don't care about this enough to put my skin in the game. I don't care about this enough to dedicate any resources to it, but I'm more than happy for you to dedicate your resources to it.
Yeah. Well, I think it's even something in a sense lower than that of it's a falsehood of not trying to get something from free out of your employees, but
exactly.
It's also about wanting to advertise something you're not doing. So, you know, attracting, you know, customers or responding to a market need for better reliability and being able to point at, oh, yes, we do these things, or, you know, we used to call it window dressing reliability when you advertise it, but there's nothing behind it. And it can also be not even at the CEO level. It can show up in mid-executive levels or even mid-management levels because there is a pressure or desire for it. And they need, when things go wrong, to advertise that they did the right things, even though they didn't. Right.
So, exactly. It's just lazy leadership, in a very basic way.
Well, I think if we want to solve it, I actually want to go a level deeper than lazy, because it could also be a survival technique and really not 100% their fault. So if you're a mid-level manager and you know that people's heads are getting chopped off for poor reliability, but the executives don't get it, that they need to fund it, they just think it's something you do it different or do it better without funding, you're kind of stuck where you know, because it's not well-funded, that it's not going to go well again. And you need to figure out a survival strategy. And one survival strategy is to point at all these initiatives that, you know, quote unquote existed, even though they really weren't done or, you know, fully committed to. But sometimes, you know, that's what occurs. And then as an employee under them, you kind of end up stuck, you know, in this weird situation too, where you end up becoming the person potential. You know, they're almost passing the buck to you just out of survival, not really maliciousness. So, the effects of it can be evident and motivations can be very different at different levels of the organization.
And I suppose my observation too is let's call it physics of failure or very cause and effect at the lowest level, because it's actually irrational for an employee to give up their free time to put any amount of effort into something that the company at least nominally values, but for which they get no reward. And what I mean by that is, if your main job is to design a hydraulic pump, every hour, every day you spend supporting the company's vision, perhaps attending public events, perhaps writing papers or whatever it is that they want you to do so they can feel better about themselves, it means that the thing that you are paid to do against which you get assessed every year suffers. That's the only thing that happens. So if you are dedicating time to these other things where the company actually doesn't really care at a very individual level if you do it or not, you actually see a deterioration in your work quality and by extension, how you get assessed each year. It is typically, in my experience, those poor performers who flock to these initiatives because they need to have a feather in their cap. They need to say, look, I might not be good at my job in terms of the core skills, but I support the company's initiative by turning up here, doing this, that, and the other. And you get this weird mix of competence and incompetence. And essentially, 2 years later, whatever that initiative was becomes a buzzword.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. And then there's also the thing about, you know, people in their careers have periods where they feel like zombies, right? And some of these situations you're describing are kind of like the parasites that get latched on slowly and keep slowly draining you to becoming that, where your heart, you know, isn't in it anymore for good reason, right?
Mm-hmm.
So from a personal standpoint, and that even goes beyond reliability, I think just in general practice for your career, I think monitoring your personal, you know, return on investment, what you're putting into your job and your career and what you get back and how it affects your greater life too is a real important thing to keep on your personal dashboard. And I think that probably companies look for people who aren't watching that, right? And they're
exactly.
They're vulnerable to it. So just I think simply just not being vulnerable to it and keeping it on your dashboard, even in companies where that's the culture, you probably can minimize how it affects you just because you're not as easy a target. So yeah, I think at a personal standpoint, evaluating what you're getting back for your efforts and anything you do in your life, you know, whatever your goals are, that's pretty important. But then specifically with the reliability thing, it's, you know, I think that, again, you should assess how well does the company match your commitment to reliability with theirs. And if there's a big enough mismatch, you should break up. It's not really different than any other relationship, right? If you're dating somebody
right.
And, you know, if you're dating and you guys have dramatically different, you know, objectives and there's a mismatch, it's really going to be constant conflict. You should consider moving on. And that really can be not in a kind of rage quit kind of way, but just the best conclusion. And, one of the ways to decide if you think it's fixable or not is to look at where in the organization at different levels, what the commitment looks like. So for example, if you see, let's say you're an engineer, senior engineer, and right above you, your management, you see a real lack of putting resource or committing to what needs to be done, and you end up in that situation. But then you look above them and you see very sincere language at the executive level. It could simply be a lack of understanding at the executive level of what it takes to do it. And the middle level management doing the kind of survival thing, like I said. So that's solvable. If there is a sincere desire to do it at the top level, it's a matter of educating them, finding a way to help them understand that reliability is not a freebie. That it takes work and it slows down product development schedules and it costs money and time. And, you know, so and then they might be like, oh, OK, we do need to budget for this. We do need to make we do need to put indicators in the program that indicate we should slow down because things aren't going, you know, we're going to, you know, have issues. And they begin to understand the real time to release is not releasing the product and then having a whole 1 year phase of recovery because you had issues. That's really part of the product development process, right? That year of recovery. And it's embarrassing as opposed to adding a couple months to get, you know, better reliability work in the before you release it the first time. And so I wouldn't give up if that's the situation. I would work on figuring out a way to get everybody to understand really what, you know, that's kind of your job to educate people on reliability. And your management, if their heart's in the right place, will get on board with that too because it's going to save them constantly being stuck between a rock and a hard place. You know, they don't know how to educate the people above them to stop saying, you're responsible for this, but I'm not funding it.
Yeah, you raise a lot of good points. Sorry for interrupting. One thing that you said struck a chord with me, and that was the relationship piece. Because you and I have both walked into these organizations where you have the vice presidents, the CEOs, the board of directors saying these things, printing these posters, and you have a disenfranchised employee base. But you say, well, in any relationship, if that's the case, if your goals are so fundamentally different, you break up. But in these organizations, these people haven't broken up. It's like that divorced couple that aren't allowed to divorce. There's finger pointing. There is there is blame, there is animosity, there's a complete lack of trust. And I think that your analogy of a broken relationship, where in many cases, for whatever reason, people don't divorce themselves, is quite apt.
Yeah, yeah. And there's of equal complexity. I mean, actually, especially in America, because your employment, you aren't, in a way, with the dating analogy isn't accurate. It's really more of a marriage analogy, where it's not simply mm-hmm. stopping dating this person. It's, okay, somebody has to move out. Okay, how do we split the finances? Okay, how do we handle the kids? Okay, and when you're employed, especially in America, that is – it's a big deal, because in America, even our health insurance is tied to our employment. If you walk out the door, if you're like, you know what, I just can't anymore, you have no health insurance, or you have to pay crazy dollar value for it. You know, your 401k is tied, you know, program is tied through your company. Your everything, your whole life, it affects a tremendous amount of things. So it's not that simple. And it's not even just the paycheck, it's other aspects. So it is hard.
And if you go to a new organization, you start again. Yeah, it's absolutely.
Yeah, your vacation, right? I mean, like, you know, you've worked a long time and you have accrued a lot of vacation, you know, per year. And now you go to a new organization and they're like, yeah, you're back to 2 weeks or something crazy, you know? And so it really does require a very conscious analysis of deciding to fix it, try to fix it, or, you know, go. So it is hard. But, you know, like, probably the complexity of like a crazy divorce, at the end of the day, it was worth it. But you stopped and you thought about it logically, not just emotionally, you know, where it's easier if it's, you know, a lighter thing. So, it's kind of, it is interesting. And it is interesting. It's one that's probably a huge factor in even just job satisfaction, right, is the sense of accomplishment. Because you do, I mean, you spend a lot of time at work, and, you know, you tie it to your personal, you know, self-worth, you know, in a lot of ways. And, to have it feel like you just can't accomplish it and you're always just mitigating blame as best you can, that's not a great way to spend every day.
And I do think, as a reliability engineer or a quality engineer, or let's call it disenfranchised engineer, I think engineers sometimes really struggle to sell the management, so what? Why should you do this thing? Why am I keep telling you we need to do this for Mika or what have you, without actually backing it up with, this is what it means for the business? And what I mean by that, I've seen so many presentations and so many reports where it is recommended you do this, but the manager, who is trying to work out whether they should or shouldn't, isn't given a dollar figure, even a rough order of magnitude, even how much it's going to cost to actually implement this versus how many years, how much money it's going to make over a certain period of time. And even when we talk about, hey, if you do it for Mika, it'll reduce your design, your schedule, and the amount of resources you spend on design or development or product development costs in total, there often just tends to be, I'd argue, a sermon approach. You just have to do it because this is what you have to do, to management. So I found that where possible, reliability engineers really need to put together a business case that is simple to understand and not the traditional business case per se. The bottom line up front, if you do this, we're likely going to save this amount of money over this period of time, and here's why. I find that can help as well. Do you have any other tidbits for reliability engineers in a similar situation?
Yeah, I think that's what you've brought up is great, because that's where the responsibility falls on the reliability engineers, that I think that they fall down. You know, we're talking a lot about pointing fingers at how management falls down and does everything. A big part of the reliability engineer's role that I see not, you know, always consistently embraced is this connecting reliability to the business. You're really the only person who can do that. I mean, if you think about it, the executives are running a business. To them, it's quarter to quarter. Like, they get fired if they don't meet their business goals. If you talk to them about anything that doesn't have a business metric or showing an ROI in business, like, it's how are they, you know, they're not going to listen. So you can't just say things like, you need to do this and things will be better. You need to tell them ROI. ROI is return on investment. So you need to tell them exactly what they're going to invest and exactly what the return is, and for small increments. And then the last component of that is credibility, right? Because you're saying it, is it true? So you can't undervalue the idea of getting small wins to build your credibility and then go for bigger and bigger investments, right? It would be like, you know, if we're going to use other analogies, like if somebody came to you and said they're going to do personal investments for you as a financial advisor, I'm not going to give them all my money off the bat. I'll give them a smaller amount. You know, see what they, oh, look, they got 20% on it. Okay, all right, let's see. Let's, there's some credibility. So it's kind of the same. So the reliability engineer, instead of, it's another thing too, instead of sitting there and just feeling helpless too, it also is going to be really great, you know, as far as making you feel like you are addressing the problem and not just banging your head on the wall, by stopping and saying, okay, let's look for a you know, a small win. All right, halt testing can be done quickly, provides immediate design input, and you can redo it and demonstrate, you know, robustness increase very quickly. Well, there's a good one, and it's inexpensive, you know. So mm-hmm. you can go and say, okay, 3 days of test time is going to be around whatever, $7,000. We're going to have an engineer on site for it, another couple thousand dollars. You know, you say, okay, for 20 grand, we're expect, you know, since we've never done it before, historically, from what I've checked in other, you know, design programs or whatever, you can expect a 20% increase in robustness. And I would say, based on some of the issues we had last year, that would have been enough to mitigate issue X and Y, which cost us $3 million. So potentially we're talking about a $25,000 investment that could get us three, you know, save us $3 million at this next product release. And we can do it in about two weeks or a month. I mean, that's pretty concise and specific, and not that hard to show it happened even before you released a product and look for the $3 million. I've seen a lot of managers' eyes really pop open when you show them something failed at a little bit over the required stress level, or actually my best one was a negative stress level. It actually, I can tell that story later if you want, but I actually found the negative stress margin once, and you should have seen the shock. They were like, holy crap, we would have gotten destroyed in the field. It was for a robotic system. So, I mean, there's ownership on the reliability engineer side too. Part of your role is to sell this and connect it to the business, because you're not speaking in a language that they speak otherwise.
And you need to be careful when you're talking to these people. They're smart people. You might not agree with them. You might not, you might have that healthy level of cynicism that most employees have with the upper management of their organization, but they're typically not idiots. If you treat them like idiots or suggest that they are idiots for not doing what you're saying or not understanding what you're saying, you've lost your audience and you become that reliability guy.
Oh yeah.
And you put your cause back by years in many cases.
Yeah. And it's simply a matter of they speak a different language, if you frame it that way. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like trying to talk with somebody else who speaks a different language, and you speak down to them and you speak louder and slower and, you know, just very condescending. Yep. And they're not dumb. They just speak a different language. And, you know, it's the same thing. If you learn their language, you're going to converse fluidly and fantastically, right? You know, exactly. So I guess we're finding a lot of basic human relationship stuff that we apply it to the workplace, because you're working with other humans. And but I would like to also share the red flag that to me would say, consider just leaving your company. The red flag would be, and this is the, you start dating somebody and you find out they're totally psychotic, just go, you're not working with this. You know, they drive past your house every night, whenever they hang out outside your work. It's like, I think we're breaking up.
That's not okay, is it?
No, it's not. And,
okay, I'll write this down.
Write that down. Red flag.
Might explain a couple of things in my life, but no worries.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's a different podcast. This is to me the you know, really considered not investing in it further, is that if you have an opportunity to talk to or hear dialogue with upper executives and not just the like VP of R&D. I'm talking about like VP of marketing, sales, any people up there that have strong influence. And you hear them say, you know, of course we use the language of reliability, but right now we're at this failure rate, and yeah, it costs us this and that, but it's okay. It's fine. I don't really see a need to change it or drive it. So the reason why I say leave that is if they feel that it is okay, it's impossible. It's impossible to get them to implement this. There is no return on investment that could exist, because any investment they make is providing a return they don't want. So there's a subtle difference in that language, but listen for it with people who are the influencers at the top. And I'll say again what it is, just so you know, you remember and it's clear. if they are okay with where the failure rate's at in private. In public, of course, they're like, oh, no, we have whatever. But there really are situations where they're like, it's okay. That's they have to publicly say it's not, and the company has to publicly say it's not. But some people are like, no, this business model works. You know, it's funny. I just came across recently a product that actually is doing that. Actually, it's crap. I don't know how to describe it without giving a name. It's not a customer of mine, but it's something I came across. And they actually have a poor reliability, which increases sales because they advertise that they can do something their competitors can't. So they make more initial sales. And then what they do is they have a really good program for going and helping the customer correct it. But the customer is already committed to their brand. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's like advertising. I don't know. Right. It would be like buying two cars and advertise, or two tires. And one company advertises they're an 80,000 mile tire and the other one is a 60. But they're both really 60,000 mile tires. And then you just like send them a rebate when they complain at 60,000 miles, their tires ran short. So there's no actual desire to make it better. They found a business model they're sticking with. So, you know, that's what I'm talking about. I mean, not as diabolical, but that kind of thing. So, yeah.
I that could be worthy of another podcast, because I call it the Nokia syndrome. Nokia was a really, you know, industry leading mobile phone producer.
Yeah, yeah.
But said, what we're doing is okay. This smartphone thing, yeah, whatever. That's not our core business. And here they are now. And for those who don't know, I mean, Nokia still exists, but it got in the smartphone industry very, very late, and it had to do it in partnership with Microsoft. And so the Nokia phones, the smartphones they eventually started to create were all Windows phones, and they just missed that boat spectacularly. That really cost them millions, if not billions of dollars. And I called Adam exactly what you just said then, the Nokia syndrome.
Yeah. Oh, it's interesting.
It just helps me. At least I think people get that analogy, because everyone can remember the Nokia 3110 brick, which
I remember the ring. I remember the ring. You know, it had that very distinctive default ringtone.
Exactly.
Right.
It was very robust. It could take a pounding.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah.
And so people loved them for it, but they were, I suppose, internally arrogant. They thought, we're good. We don't need to change our model.
That's the thing you added in your article with the Fatboy Slim cover. You know,
that's right. We're number one.
Why try harder?
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's exactly how you fall behind. But it looks like we have a second. I can tell you the robot story, the negative stress margin. I never in my life thought I would see it. So,
okay.
Usually we do. You know, you do a test, and you're looking for how much margin you have and what you believe your use case stresses are that you want to, you know, make statements on, you know. So you're like, okay, this stress to failure mode is whatever, you know, 20 pounds of torque to this, you know, is what we expect in use case. So we'll design it to 40 or 30 or something like that. Yep. So I had a customer where they had a very robust product, and it had two robotic arms in it that did two different tasks. And they were creating very wisely, after doing market analysis, they saw an opening for a less expensive, smaller footprint one that was at a lower cost point, because there were customers who didn't do the duty cycle that, you know, they had for their other model. So there really was an opening here for a lot of customers who would probably purchase this. And it went slower, of course, because they had one robotic arm now doing multiple duties. But that was fine, because they developed it, and you know, the initial approach was, oh, this is easy. We're making a simpler version of what we have. But the one big engineering question is, you're taking your one robotic arm, you're increasing its tasks and what it has to do and its functionality. So, you know, there's actual mass, there's forces, there's all kinds of other things going on. Is acceleration rates changing? So they built the initial arm with simple changes, tried to use as many of the existing parts, and it seemed to work totally fine in the lab. And they were like, this is great. Like, they're planning just, you know, kind of going forward as planned. And then I began investigating it with reliability, you know, some reliability tools. I said, all right, you know, let's hold on. Let's really check it out. Let's measure the reliability for random failure rates. Let's take a look at stress margins. Let's look at different things. And so I wanted to do a stress margin evaluation. Now, this was built in a different kind of frame, a kind of prototype frame that was like bolted together. And what happened is, when I would lean on it, so we started coming up with test, stress margin tests, but even before doing the test, when I would lean on the frame, the robot would stop. And okay. I was like, what is going on, right? So it was kind of weird. I'm like, wow, we clearly have a low margin here. What's happening? what this is what at the end of the day was actually happening. I called it the Fonzie effect. I said it was the Fonzie robot.
Sure.
This is why. It was the frame allowed vibration, resonance. And what was happening is actually the robot was not strong enough and it was binding. And the resonance in the frame was keeping it going. The way like when something's stuck and you punch it, like Fonzie would punch the jukebox to get it unstuck, it would keep going. It was constantly bopping itself because of the resonance in the frame. It was binding and unbinding in these very small increments that you almost couldn't see. And they were running it slower, so they didn't really notice that well. So if they had taken that design and built it with the correct welded stiffer frame, it could have been 100% failure mode out of the gate, right? Like, it was actually the thing had a negative stress margin where it was too weak but looked like it worked. And that was a jaw drop. Talk about return on investment, you know, for taking an investigation in the stress margins, which we didn't even have to do the test, just me trying to set up and play with the thing. I was like, something's weird. So that one goes in the books.
That is the first time I've ever heard of that.
Isn't that crazy?
Especially a pop culture reference to Happy Days and reliability engineering. So
yeah, exactly.
You tick two big boxes in one hit.
I'm glad I could do that.
But cool. Anyway, Adam, I think we need to wrap this one up because, we have run out of time more than any other reason. So if anyone has any ideas or any questions or any points they'd like to raise or any comments of their own experiences of organizations where their management tell them to do something for which they're not prepared to pay you to do, for what they're not prepared to pay you to do, feel free to leave a comment in this podcast comment section. And we do welcome feedback. It actually drives a lot of what we talk about. On these podcasts.
It does. And it's funny is that when we have certain topics, I'm like, okay, people don't comment because it's, you know, maybe they didn't get experience to it. Everybody listening to this is nodding their head. So if we don't see people comment,
true.
They're just being lazy. so don't be lazy,
right.
Everybody. Comment. Take action.
No worries, Adam. Well, thank you very much for your time. Much appreciated. Illuminating as always. And look forward to talking soon.
Yeah. Take care. Bye, Chris.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.